This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Thanks for tuning in. Glad you decided to listen in today. I'll have joining me momentarily the founder of Liberty.me, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. I know you're going to enjoy my conversation with Jeffrey. And in the last segment of today's program, I'm going to give you a market forecast for 2015, give you our take on where the markets might be headed and what you might consider adding as far as strategies are concerned to your nest egg. And then I'll also be talking about the wealth gap on today's program. Even though, according to the economic reports, the market is growing like crazy, the economy is going like crazy, Main Street seems to not be feeling it. How can you describe that? I'll talk about the fact that the sales of Rolls-Royces are at all-time highs, and yet 3 in 5 Americans don't have enough reserve in their savings to pay a $500 car repair bill. How do you explain that? I'll talk about that on today's program as well. Quick reminder also that we'll be starting a new retirement rules class for 2015 on January the 24th. It's a one-day class. It'll be held at the Western Michigan University campus in downtown Grand Rapids. The cost is $49 for you and a guest. That includes book, handouts, and lunch for you and a guest. Go to newretirementrules.com to get more information. Again, the website to get more information or register is newretirementrules.com. Returning once again to the Everything Financial Radio program is Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Many of you have undoubtedly heard Jeffrey on the program here before. And Jeffrey, welcome back.
It's really fun to be back. Thank you so much for inviting me during this waning days of the holiday season here.
Well, tell us, Jeffrey, let the listeners know what you've been up to. You were launching Liberty.me, I think, the last time you were on. And tell us what you've been working on.
Well, a couple of things. One was Liberty.me. We had released the website last spring and summer just as a test, and we just last week came out with our full release. We've been in beta for a long time, and I'm super excited about it because we learned a lot. You know, this is the market economy at work here, and so we improved a lot. And things are just hopping, and so I'm loving that. That's consuming a lot of my energies. It's a fun place, the Global Liberty Community. So I encourage listeners to go and check that out. And I'm also doing a lot of work for one of my favorite organizations, the Foundation for Economic Education. Been writing a lot to them and consulting with them on their digital presence and working on a new website there and doing a lot of speaking and writing.
Well, terrific. Well, Jeffrey, as we're chatting here, and I should point out that we're recording this actually the day after Christmas, so some of us just never take any time off. What's really probably got a lot of people excited as they traveled this holiday season is when they went to fill up their automobile at the gas pump, it didn't hurt nearly as much as it did last Christmas. What's behind this?
It's such an exciting trend. I paid $2.13, and other friends of mine are paying as low as $2, and I'm expecting it to fall further. It's really exciting to me for a number of reasons. When you think about all the powerful interest groups in the world that are desperate for higher gas prices, it's a kind of a kick to make you realize that the price system and the market, as it works, is not in the control of the hands of any. In the end, the most powerful people can't actually control it, because people like you and me and all the consumers you mentioned are the people who benefit the most from lower gas prices. But the environmentalists want higher gas prices. State and local governments want higher gas prices. The oil industry wants higher gas prices. Some of the world's most powerful states and biggest billionaire moguls want higher gas prices. The Fed wants higher gas prices. And despite all of that, we're still seeing this beautiful downward pressure as a result of market conditions and technology mostly.
So, Jeffrey, a couple things come to mind there. Let me follow up on the first comment. And you mentioned a number of entities, government entities, the Federal Reserve, that all want higher gas prices. Why?
Well, in the case of the environmentalists, they want us to drive less. They don't like internal combustion engines. They've been bitter ever since the Industrial Revolution, basically. So, you know, they're puritanical, and they don't like what they consider to be our selfish driving. They think it's ruining the planet, blah, blah, blah. We've heard it all a million times. They want us to drive around on little – they want us to be pedaling around on bicycles like peasants in the era of Mao in China. So those are those groups. The other group that does not like a lower gas prices like this is the oil industry, because higher prices means higher profitability and, very importantly, more financial viability for processing and exploration and extraction. So they want higher gas prices. They would like them to be, you know, in the $120, $130, $140 range. We knew this during the Bush presidency. They're always pushing for higher gas prices. There's a funny story that one of Bush One's first advisors to the White House said, listen, I think you need to make low gas prices a priority of your administration. That will cause people to love you. And he exploded and said, what do you mean? That's exactly the opposite of what we want. That'll ruin the oil industry and cause people to drive much more. And that's where we're trying to work against that. What we need is less driving and more profits per gallon. So, you know, you've got the oil industry behind the idea of higher gas prices. There's another thing with regard to the Fed. There's Keynesian economic theory believes that inflation and macroeconomics is pulled around by crucial price indicators. And they consider oil to be one of those things. And they're terrified of deflation. They think that it's bad. I think they're completely wrong about this. But they panic at lower gas prices, especially on this level, and because they think it's going to bring the economy into recession. I think the truth is actually the opposite. But they've been working now for 5 years to inflate the economy and raise the prices of everything, especially crucial assets like oil. They've been unsuccessful for a variety of reasons.
So why are with all the special interests, with all the corporate money wanting higher gas and oil prices, what's causing prices to move dramatically lower?
Well, I think one is that the Fed has not been able to manufacture the inflation that they want. They dumped a ton of new money into the financial system, but that money is stuck in the vaults of banks due to massive changes in velocity. So there's that upward price pressure has not been effective.
But Janet Yellen says that lower gas prices are not deflationary.
That, well, you know, she may say that because she's terrified of this, and she monitors every word she says, you know, so she's scared of that. And a lot of people, I know for a fact, that are scared about what low gas prices are going to mean. They think it's going to drag down all of economic life, and they feel the same way about real estate and commodities in general. So you know, look. This Janet Yellen is a joke, really. It's just laughable. You know, the idea that I don't think she has an idea in her head, quite frankly, really. But I mean, if she said that publicly, then she's certainly right about that. I just don't think she actually believes it. But the other factor that's been huge for the oil industry has just been technological improvement across the board. Better mining equipment, better processing equipment, and then fracking, of course, and new shale discoveries has been an unbelievable boom to the entire industry. And this comes, about 10 years after a kind of frenzy about peak oil. You know, there were lots of geologists and scientists saying, look, we're going to run out of oil. You know, this is just right around the corner. Well, they turned out to be wrong, too. The gloom and doomers in this case were completely wrong. So here's the thing, Dennis. I really enjoy watching this because it should remind us all that the power of the market price and market forces is so relentless. It's so humble, just a little digit, but it works relentlessly, and it doesn't obey any of the world's most powerful people. It just goes about its own business, doing its own thing, and I think that should bring us a lot of comfort. I think it's a very beautiful idea. I have an article coming out about that subject today. And if you look at the data, we are paying lower price for gasoline today than we did 40 years ago. Can you believe that? Despite everything.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Jeffrey, we're coming up on the end of this segment. You mentioned your article. If someone wanted to read many, you're such a prolific writer, where would they learn a little bit more about your work?
Oh, just head over to liberty.me. You can see my publishing site, which is tucker.liberty.me. And I have up there about 250 articles, and I post, Dennis, just about every day. You know, economics is such an exciting and fun topic. It's a kind of human drama. That's the way I think about economics. It's not just all about technical stuff. It's really about human beings and their choices. And that's what I try to chronicle on my website.
Terrific. Well, we will continue our conversation with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. We will continue our conversation with this week's special guest, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, in the next segment. In this segment, I want to talk about something that you're really not hearing a lot about in the mainstream media. And I want to start with an article that was published on Zero Hedge, and it was written by Tyler Durden. And it was titled, 3 in 5 Americans Don't Have Savings to Cover Unexpected Bills. And my topic for this segment is something that I'll call the wealth gap. And let me give you just a bit from Mr. Durden's article. While various CNBC anchors may be willing to say that the U.S. is growing gangbusters yet again, confusing the liquidity-oozing equity markets with the economy, there are a couple hundred million Americans who would beg to differ. The reason is that according to the latest bank rate survey released today, more than 3 in 5 Americans don't have enough money in their savings accounts to cover any unexpected bills such as a $500 car repair or a $1,000 emergency room visit. In fact, only 38% of respondents say they have enough funds in their bank accounts to cover even the most mundane of spending emergencies. Most others would need to take on debt or cut back elsewhere. Now, the Wall Street Journal reported, citing the same bank rate survey, that, and I'm quoting, a solid majority of Americans say they have a household budget, but too few have the ability to cover expenses outside their budget without going into debt or turning to family and friends for help. Their survey found that an unexpected bill would cause 26% to reduce spending elsewhere, while 16% would borrow from family or friends, and 12% would put the expense on a credit card. The remainder didn't know what they would do or what other arrangements they would make to cover an unexpected expense. Now, interestingly, you can look at the news, and about the same time Mr. Durden's article was published, the BBC published an article titled, Rolls-Royce Breaks Record Sales Again in 2014. Rolls-Royce Motor Cars, according to the BBC article, sold a record number of cars last year, breaking through the 4,000 car mark for the first time in its 111-year history. Rolls-Royce sold 4,063 cars, up 12% last year, and marking the fifth consecutive year of record sales. Sales in the U.S. increased by almost a third, by 40% in Europe and 20% in the Middle East. Now, these are not inexpensive cars. The firm, meaning Rolls-Royce, sold more cars worth more than $237,000 than any of its rivals, and many customers are paying for customization. Searching the news, you find another article that was published by CNBC, and it said, Manhattan apartment prices hit record high. A bit from this article. The average apartment price in Manhattan hit a record $1.72 million in 2014 as New York wealthy and overseas rich continued to seek safety in the New York skyline. Prices continue to rise in New York as strong demand competes for historically low supply. The average sale price for the year topped the previous peak in 2008 of $1.591 million, according to Miller Samuel Real Estate Appraisers. For the fourth quarter, average sales prices topped $1.74 million, up 13% from the fourth quarter of 2013. So how do you explain this? Rolls-Royce has record sales, Manhattan real estate prices have reached record levels, and yet 3 in 5 Americans don't have enough money to cover a $500 unexpected car repair bill without going to relatives for help or without putting the expense on a credit card. Well, I'd like to put forth that when you understand monetary policy and what the Fed is doing, that is the culprit. There was a study published, an article published by Western Journalism January 6th this past week, and it really does a nice job of explaining this phenomenon of what I call the wealth gap. A recently released Pew Research Center study confirms what every thinking American has understood for quite some time. The wealth gap between rich and poor has widened considerably since the onset of the financial crisis in 2008. The study statistics probably underestimate the plight of struggling families and individuals compared to upper income groups, as the median wealth of upper income families totaled $639,000 in 2013, 6.6 times the median wealth of middle income families, which was $96,000. This compares with 4.5 times the gap in 2007 between the two groups. So in just 6 years, this wealth gap between upper-income families and middle-income families has increased from 4.5 times to 6.6 times. That's a 50% increase in the wealth gap in just 6 years. Now, the article continues, along with a widening wealth gap, the overall outlook for the middle and lower classes is decidedly bleak, as stated in the report. The latest data reinforce the larger story of America's middle-class household wealth stagnation over the past three decades. The study adds, middle and lower-income families' wealth levels in 2013 are comparable to where they were in the early 1990s. That's more than 20 years with no change. While this Pew study quantifies to some extent the declining financial status of the vast majority of Americans, it does not point to the actual cause of the widening gulf between upper and lower income groups. The reason for the wealth gap and for the financial crisis in general has been the Federal Reserve's expansionary monetary policy, which began in earnest with quantitative easing under former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. Quantitative easing is just a fancy word for money printing. John Williams of Shadow Stats estimated the U.S. money supply has doubled since the start of the financial crisis, and this expansionary policy shows little sign of stopping under current Fed Chair Janet Yellen. Here's the point. Inflation or money printing is always redistributive. In other words, it always redistributes wealth. Like any petty counterfeiter, the new money allows its creator, the Fed, to receive free goods without having to produce or exchange. Moreover, by the time the new money filters out into the economy, its purchasing power has been reduced as prices have gone up. Inflationary monetary policy is devastating to those who receive their income in wages or who are on a fixed income. Since wages are paid in money, each monetary unit that's received by wage earners is diluted by the expansion of its supply. Although nominal wage rates may rise, the real purchasing power declines. Now, real wages have remained stagnant for decades. The Pew study doesn't mention this, but wages have not progressed when adjusted for inflation since 1971, which, not surprisingly, coincides with President Nixon's decision to abandon the gold standard. That allowed the Fed to print money, which has widened the wealth gap. So how do you reverse the wealth gap? According to the article, and I would agree, just stop printing money. However, do we really see that happening? Probably not. That's why we think it's important when doing your investment planning, when deciding how to manage your nest egg, that you look at strategies that will help you protect the real purchasing power of your wealth and help you not be a victim of this wealth gap. Because as we've just discussed, the further you are from the printing press, the less likely it is that you'll benefit from money printing. In fact, it's highly likely that money printing will harm you. If you are managing a nest egg and would like more information, I would encourage you, as the new year gets started here, to consider attending our new retirement rules class. We have a class coming up the end of the month in January on the 24th. It's Saturday. Our class will begin at 9. It will conclude at 2:30. It will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. The cost is just $49. That covers the book, all your handouts, and lunch for you and a guest. Information is available at newretirementrules.com. The website, once again, newretirementrules.com. I'll be back after these words.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Monday, Monday, Monday. Always Sunday. In the rich man's world.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. In this segment, I will be continuing my conversation with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. You can learn more about Jeffrey's work at liberty.me, and I would encourage you to check it out. Jeffrey, last time you were on the program, we talked about this cryptocurrency that was really just exploding called Bitcoin, and I want to get an update and just see what your take is on this, but before we jump in, just in case some of our listeners are not familiar with the term cryptocurrency or Bitcoin, give us a 101 level explanation.
Just real quick, it's a money for the digital age. It's a money and payment system combined that is not controlled by a central bank, but rather it lives on a distributed network, so it belongs to the whole of humanity. It's really an international currency designed for the internet age. And it came about in 2009 and just grew and grew. 2013 was a huge year. 2014 was an interesting year because the price was mostly flat. It had peaked at about 1,200 at the dollar exchange rate and fell down to about 400 and stayed between 300 and 400 all year long. And it seems a little bit boring, but actually what was going on was there's a gigantic infrastructure that's developed around it. So more and more people are accepting Bitcoin from Kickstarter over to Overstock, Wikipedia and archive.org. And there's all sorts of apps that are coming out. So what we're seeing is the typical case of an industrial revolution style development. You know, the infrastructure is growing, it's developing, it's getting better, and use is growing. I think that 2015 is going to be a great year for cryptocurrency and for Bitcoin.
So Jeffrey, if you study history and look at what fiat currencies or how they've performed historically, we have a failure rate when it comes to fiat currencies of 100%. And historically speaking, when fiat currencies fail, often commerce is now conducted with hard money. Go back to gold or silver. Could Bitcoin be the gold and silver fallback as fiat currencies around the world are continued to be weakened by central banks?
Oh, most certainly. And I think we're going to see this in a big way at the very next currency crisis, wherever that may occur. There have been some talk in just last week about Russia's failing economy right now, and about Russian moguls moving out of the Russian currency into Bitcoin. So we're obviously starting to see this. People like it because it's easily transported. It can't be confiscated by governments. It lives on your smartphone or your home computer, or you can even print it out and stick it in a safe. However you do it, it's out of the reach of governments. So, and it's much more liquid than something like gold.
So this has to drive governments crazy, at least the ones that understand it. Have there been some efforts by governments or by regulators to try to get control of Bitcoin?
They're trying to control the exchange in and out of national currencies to Bitcoin and back again. That's the part they can control, because they can't control Bitcoin itself. So that is going on, and in fact, I think that's one of the big problems that Bitcoin faces right now, is that nobody knows for sure how governments are going to treat it. It's this brand new thing. You know, it wasn't invented by any big shots at the Federal Reserve or the Treasury. It lives completely outside of the state. And, yeah, it's got a lot of people very worried. But, it's one of those things. It's a little like internal combustion or flight. It's like once the thing has been invented, nobody's going to be able to get rid of it. And what's most exciting to me, and I think this is a great development over the last 12 months, we're seeing it's not just Bitcoin. Bitcoin is one species of what's called a peer-to-peer technology. What this does is it connects individuals with other individuals to make trades and meet financial needs regardless of geography. And thanks to the internet, we're seeing this peer-to-peer technology affect not just money or cryptocurrencies, but also lending and crowdfunding, but also goods. Things like eBay and Etsy, all sorts of things, custom-made products and food. We're seeing things like Eat With and Blue Apron. surfing, these sort of things, starting peer-to-peer dinner parties that are going against government regulations in a fun way, and services to really help the job market with Odesk and Elance, and these sort of things, and transportation with Uber, and even office space. So this is the great trend of our time. I think it's as significant and important as the Industrial Revolution. In fact, Dennis, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but I have a book coming out in about 10 days called Bit by Bit, How P2P is Freeing the World.
Well, certainly we'll look for that. You mentioned Jeffrey. In fact, I just read an article on Eat With, and I was not familiar with it. But maybe just give the listeners an example by explaining what is Eat With or some of these other peer-to-peer networks, because it's a very interesting trend.
Yeah, well, you know, we all know that the dinner party is kind of dead. It's a lot of work, and people don't do it that much anymore. Well, Eat With is sort of all about foodies who want to get to know each other and cook for each other, but they do it on a commercial basis. So if I'm holding a dinner party, I'm making some lamb chops or whatever, and I want to invite some people over, and they can throw me $10 a person that I have the resources to feed 10 people. They can just register and come over, and we can have a wonderful time. And I pay the bills. They have a good time, and everybody leaves happy. It's a kind of a way of turning your home into a restaurant. It's very difficult for regulators to control this because you can't really have a government come along and say, oh, you can't have people over to your house, and you can't have people pay you $10 to do this. You know, it makes a mess of sort of government zoning laws and the tax laws and a whole series of regulations. What it's doing is it's bringing back things like the dinner party and allowing people to kind of connect peer-to-peer in ways they hadn't been able to do in the past. Again, this is all thanks to the Internet. I really believe, Dennis, that we're just at the beginnings of this revolution. The Internet has changed the world. It's been around for now for 20 years as a kind of consumer-oriented service, and now we're really starting to see it take off with these peer-to-peer technologies. And I don't believe that old-fashioned government regulations are going to survive. We've already seen how local taxi cab monopolies are being crushed by services like Lyft and Uber and Boat Around and Get Around and Sidecar and all these different scooter services and all these things. And governments have, for the most part, you know, they fight against them a little bit, but basically they can slow down the trends, but they can't stop them. Dennis, one of the funny things that's proof of this is that the price of New York taxi medallions is in a free fall. It went from $1 million, now it's down to about $600,000, and this has all happened within the last 6 months.
Just amazing, interesting. So the book coming out Bit by Bit, Jeffrey, give our listeners a little bit of a sneak preview as to other peer-to-peer type programs. You've mentioned some like Lyft and Sidecar that I'm not familiar with. I made a note just to do a little homework on my own, but kind of give us a little bit of a preview of what's in the book.
Well, you know, I think our ambition as humanity from the beginnings of time all the way up to the present is to connect with each other individually. And there's always been limits on that because we didn't really have the technology to make that possible without insofar as we weren't geographically situated next to each other. But with the Internet now, we can have this kind of peer-to-peer contact with people all over the world. And it's really changed our knowledge set and vastly broadened our opportunities for exchanging with each other. And I think that the peer-to-peer revolution is changing everything about how we borrow and lend and raise money for our companies. It's changing our travel, you know. So now, instead of always having to go to hotels, we can use Airbnb and stay with somebody at somebody's home. It's taking a lot of idle resources that would otherwise be going to waste and putting them at the service of humanity. And also, you know, but going back to the Bitcoin example, there are something like 5 billion people in the world that are unbanked, that don't have access to regular banking services, and are therefore sort of condemned to live hand to mouth, you know, just because they can only use their talents in their geographic vicinity. Bitcoin makes it possible for them to be part of a global division of labor. And that's really critical. It allows people to leave their nation states and engage with each other just as individuals. It's really revolutionary, and what I love about it most is that it's all being driven by the markets. No governments have invented these systems. These are all being driven by brilliant entrepreneurs who are figuring out new ways of doing things and bringing people together outside political systems. And I think it's so significant that it's gradually reintroducing humanity into a very old idea called human liberty. And so that's what's really behind the whole peer-to-peer revolution.
Well, Jeffrey, the time we have left, I would love to get your take on the U.S. and world economies. Any forecast for 2015 from an economic perspective?
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried about the U.S. economy right now. You know, we've been in a five-year recession. There's no doubt about it. There's a lot of hype recently about the coming recovery. I'm not convinced this recovery is real. I think it's actually just an asset inflation, and that's driving it. I don't think it's sustainable. I wonder if there's a new real estate bubble that's being blown up right now, and I know for sure there's a bubble in financial assets right now. So I'm very concerned about it. I don't see any real hope for serious GDP growth in 2015, despite what everybody is saying. So I'm not very optimistic about the U.S. right now, I'm sorry to say. And all of our growth is being driven by these technological innovations. And the tragedy is that the technological innovations have been so beautiful and so wonderful that we're not experiencing the full power of them that we might have if the government weren't so intrusive and so highly regulatory. It's really been a terrible thing to see. Nor do I see any evidence that the politicians in Washington have any intention of doing anything to improve the system.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey, always a pleasure to have you on the program. And the book, Bit by Bit, out shortly after the beginning of the new year.
Yeah, we're almost ready to ship it. I'm waiting for an introduction, and then it's going to be ready to go. I'm excited about it. It's only about 150 pages, but it's an introduction to what peer-to-peer technology means for the world economy and for human liberty in general.
I will definitely be one of the first purchasers, and I encourage the listeners to do the same. So we're going to leave it there. We'd love to have you back. Everything Financial Radio will return after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks again to our special guest this week, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, for joining us. In this segment of the program, I want to talk about a market forecast for 2015. You know, it's this time of year that a lot of pundits and prognosticators get out their crystal balls and they try to figure out, where are the markets going to go this year? What are bonds going to do? What are stocks going to do? And where should I have my money? Well, I want to talk about this topic within the context of the approach that a lot of investors today take. And that approach I like to call the one bucket approach. The one bucket approach would have investors investing in stocks and bonds and maybe some cash, or maybe some stock mutual funds and bond mutual funds and cash. And a rule of thumb is often the older you are, the closer you are to needing to use some of this money for retirement, the more of your assets that you should have invested in bonds. Well, we advocate a two-bucket approach, and we think that there should be some other asset classes included in your portfolio, given where we are today, economically speaking. So I want to talk a little bit about in today's environment and the one that we believe we're in today, and this is, again, our opinion, that having additional asset classes over and above stocks and bonds can be beneficial, because there are times, historically speaking, and we believe there may be one of these times lying ahead in the very near future, that both stocks and bonds can decline as an asset class. And our view is that if you own stocks and bonds and you're using simply a one-bucket approach to manage your assets, this could be potentially devastating to your portfolio. And again, that's our opinion. Now, I want to give you some articles to maybe back up why we feel this way. There's one from Business Insider that was published just this past week on January 6. The article quoted, actually, Gluskin Chef's David Rosenberg. Mr. Rosenberg says that the demand for bonds that's causing their prices to rally may be the beginning of a bubble. Now, just so you understand the relationship between bond yields and bond prices, as prices go up, bond yields decline. In other words, you're paying more money to get the same level of interest in terms of dollars. So they move in opposite manners. They're inversely correlated. When bond yields go down, that means bond prices are going up. Well, Mr. Rosenberg posed a very, very interesting question. He said, if I told you that the U.S. economy would be closing the year running at its fastest pace in 11 years and that unemployment would be rising at the most pronounced pace, that employment would be rising at the most pronounced pace since the 1999 boom, would you really believe that 10-year T-note yields would be hovering near 2%? The likely answer, he says, is no, because the two sets of scenarios typically do not add up. But as he also notes, a combination of conditions has sent investors to the perceived safety of U.S. bonds, pushing up their prices and plunging yields. The U.S. budget deficit fell. The new net supply of bonds coming onto the market also fell as a result. Here's a big factor. Central banks scooped up 90% of U.S. government debt that was available. Well, where is that money coming from? That money is being printed out of thin air, or has been. And of course, there's more baby boomers are looking for a steady and secure source of income, which has also boosted the demand for bonds. Rosenberg says yields at these levels do not seem sustainable. And in fact, he thinks that prices will decline. Well, that means if you own bonds in your portfolio, you could see the value of those holdings also decline. And when you look at the 10-year yield of a U.S. Treasury, the yields are at their lowest rates in nearly 55 years. That also tells you that bonds could be in a bubble. Now, Robert Shiller, who's a Yale economist, was quoted in Time magazine recently, this past week on January 6th as well. And he said that while he wouldn't say bonds are in a bubble, he thinks that bond prices likely don't have a lot more upside. Now, Mr. Shiller's got a pretty good track record. He actually wrote a book called Irrational Exuberance. And the first version of this book came out in 2000. And that book made the case that stock valuations looked awfully high and that people seemed too optimistic about tech stocks. Well, you all know what happened next. The second edition of Mr. Shiller's book, titled Irrational Exuberance, was published in 2005. And it had a new chapter about the unusually high price of real estate, and he warned that real estate might be in a bubble. Well, you know what happened that time, too. Now Mr. Shiller has added a new chapter on another asset class that has become expensive, bonds. Now he says it's not necessarily a bubble. He said it doesn't really clearly fit the classic definition of a bubble because it doesn't seem to be overly enthusiastic. But he said, bubbles are a result of a psychological feedback loop. As asset prices go up, people come up with stories to explain why, which helps push prices higher, reinforcing the story, and so on. And he said that, in his view, may be the case now with bonds as well. Another article published in Money Beat on September 23 this past year simply stated, the bull market in bonds won't end well. Worries about overheated debt markets dominated discussion at an investor conference in New York on Monday, with hedge fund managers and corporate executives expressing concerns about the bond market as the Federal Reserve moves closer toward raising interest rates. Julian Robertson, who's founder of one of the earliest hedge funds in Tiger Management Corp, said bonds are at ridiculous levels. It's a worldwide phenomenon that governments are buying bonds to keep their countries moving along economically. Howard Marks, the chairman of Oaktree Capital Group, said interest rates are unnaturally low today. And Leon Cooperman, founder of Omega Advisors, said Stock bonds are simply very overvalued. What about stocks? Well, Jeremy Grantham, according to an article in Business Insider recently, said he is a little bit bullish, but only for a little bit longer. In a quarterly letter to his clients, the veteran fund manager predicts the S&P 500 could see another 10% surge from its current level. My personal fond hope and expectation, Mr. Grantham said, is still for a market that runs deep into bubble territory, which starts at 2250 on the S&P 500 on our data, before crashing as it always does, he wrote. Well, the market, according to this article in Business Insider, is almost perfectly tracking Mr. Grantham's prediction, which may make us even a bit more nervous about his calls for a crash. Mr. Grantham made it clear that his near-term forecast may be for a little more upside in the markets. However, their base case scenario for the next 7 years regarding stocks, and I'm quoting, is a purgatory of low returns. In an article published by CNBC by Mr. John Malloy, is titled, "This chart is a ticking time bomb for stocks." Well, what's the chart? Well, the chart is a chart of margin debt. Now, if you're not familiar with margin debt is debt that someone would take on to buy securities, usually stocks. Well, the article said, and it's a very short article, I'll give you all three paragraphs here, the last 6 years for the U.S. stock market have been a buying orgy fueled by the Federal Reserve zero interest rate policy, causing the S&P 500 to triple in value. And one metric, referring to margin debt, says it may have gone too far. Borrowing to buy stocks, as measured by the New York Stock Exchange monthly margin debt figures, ended in 2014 at its highest level relative to the size of the U.S. economy since 1929. Margin debt has not been this high when measured as a percentage of the economy since 1929, and we all know what happened then. Alan Newman said, if this data doesn't count, we might as well throw everything away we've ever learned about risk because there is none. The manias of 2000 and 2007 now both look like small potatoes by comparison. He said, this is total insanity. Well, if stocks and bonds both decline in the future, what would that mean for your nest egg? And again, this is just something for you to consider. No prediction can be guaranteed to be 100% accurate. However, if you'd like to get a different perspective, if you'd like to get some ideas to potentially protect yourself and potentially even profit should these situations occur, I'd like to invite you to go to the website newretirementrules.com and get more information about our upcoming class to be held on January the 24th. The class will be held in Grand Rapids. It's $49. That covers the cost of the class for you and a guest, all handouts as well as lunch. The website again is newretirementrules.com. I'd encourage you to go check it out or register there while capacity remains. That's our show for this week. Bye.